Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is Stark Trading versus Falconbridge. Mr. Barber.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The magistrate judge in this case made at least three reversible errors in deciding the case. First, the magistrate judge ignored well-pled factual allegations, as well as the confirming admissions in the defendant's disclosure documents, in finding that an independent committee supervised an independent investment bank in preparing a fairness opinion without direct input from the defendant's management. Our allegations and their disclosure documents make it clear management provided the inputs and data for the valuation
opinion. Before you get into that, let me not sure I understand these transactions, so let me try to. So you wanted to go short on Noranda and long on Falconbridge. Now is that hedging? Is that what you're trying to do?
No, that is not what we were trying to do, Your Honor.
If Noranda if Noranda rose, which would spoil your short selling, presumably you'd make some money on Falconbridge, right? Which
well, actually,
you're long was, on. So isn't that the idea? Pardon?
No, Your Honor, we did not have a complete hedge on in this transaction.
You don't have a complete hedge, but that would be the effect, right? If Noranda falls, Falconbridge rises, so that buffers. That buffers your upside, but if Noranda rises, so your short is no good, well, at least you make some money on Falconbridge.
Well, first of all, we had a very small short position. I think it's someone mentions that we had a very short position on in Noranda, and I don't know if that's in the record or it's just something that was mentioned by the defendants. But at the end of the day, we did not have a complete hedge on.
Look, I'm not criticizing short selling. I don't have anything against short selling. You can sell short on anything you want. I'm just trying to understand why you're short in Noranda and you're long in its asset. And I'm just assuming, you know, that's hedging, right? I just want to make sure I understand the transaction. I don't understand why else one would purchase shares in two companies. They're likely to move in the same direction, right? So if you're short in one, price rises, price of your other stock will also rise, and so you'll have less of a loss. No?
Well, at the end of the day, Judge, we had a very...
What other purpose could there be for this? Just explain that to me.
I would assume, Judge, that whatever small position, short position...
What's the purpose? Just tell me what the purpose is. Why are you short in Noranda and long in Falconbridge?
I can't tell you the purpose, Judge. I don't know.
You don't know?
No, I don't, Judge. All I know is that we had a very small...
That's a really strange answer.
I don't understand
what your client is doing. You're not curious about when you have a case, aren't you curious about why your client structured its investments in this company in that fashion?
Well, what I do know, Judge, is that my client had a very significant unhedged long position in Falconbridge.
Right, and a short position in Noranda. So presumably there's some thinking going on why you're having... why you're taking long and short positions in what are clearly related assets.
Well, I can assume that there was some effort to put on a small hedge position, but at the end of the day, we were not...
That's irrelevant. I'm just curious whether this is hedging or whether there's some other motive for this.
I don't believe... I can't tell you. I would assume that the only motive would be to put some sort of a small hedge on, but I can't really tell you.
Okay, now let me see if I understand what Noranda was doing. Now, so Noranda offers its common shareholders a chance to swap their shares for preferred shares. The preferred is the price of the preferred is high, and that of course makes these common shares rise in price. And then, or at the same time, it makes the tender offer to the shareholders in Falconbridge, tendering these Noranda shares, and the Noranda shares have risen because of the swap with the preferred, the offer of the swap, and as a result, it takes fewer Noranda shares to buy Falconbridge. And so the shareholders in Falconbridge get fewer shares in Noranda than they would if the price of Noranda were lower. So is that the basic, forgetting about the alleged misrepresentation, is that the basic transaction on Noranda's side?
No, actually, the price of Noranda wouldn't impact the exchange ratio. There was a set exchange ratio of 1.
What are you talking about? The swap or the tender offer?
The tender offer.
Yes, so
the tender offer had a set exchange ratio of 1.77 shares of Noranda for each share of Falconbridge. That didn't change regardless of the price of Noranda. What we allege is
1.7 Noranda share to 1 or vice versa?
1.77 Noranda shares for each 1 share of Falconbridge.
Okay. So what if anything was the relationship between the preferred common swap and the tender offer?
The issuer bid, that's the preferred common swap that you're referring to, basically was implemented to manipulate the price of Noranda stock so that the price of Noranda stock comported with the valuation of Noranda stock that was being put forth in connection with the tender offer. So Noranda stock, which was being valued at, I can't remember the exact valuation in the tender offer, I want to say it was $19.50 to $23 a share, had historically speaking never traded at that level, been trading at 15% less than that.
So let me understand what you're saying. You're saying the swap inflates the value of Noranda shares, and since the ratio of Noranda shares to Falconbridge and the tender offer is fixed, the shareholders of Falconbridge, they're more eager to tender their shares because they're going to get these 1.77 Noranda shares, which are worth more because of that preferred common stock swap. Is that
not right? Exactly, Judge? The Falconbridge shareholders would be more likely to tender their shares if the price of Noranda stock fell within the valuation range of Noranda stock that TD was putting forth. I mean, it would
be. Why is that different from what I'm saying? The more valuable the Noranda stock seems to be, the more attractive the tender offer is to Falconbridge shareholders, isn't it?
Well, that's one aspect of it. But the other aspect of it is that it provides validity to the TD valuation. It would be difficult to put a lot of faith in the TD valuation if TD said that Noranda stock was worth 23 or 20 bucks a share and the stock was trading at 15. So the purpose of the issuer bid was to, amongst other things.
I don't understand how that's any different from what I'm saying. You're saying the purpose of the issuer bid is to make the Noranda shares look more valuable, and that's attractive to the Falconbridge shareholders. Now you're introducing a complication, which is that the increased value of the Noranda stock because of the swap makes this bank's valuation of Noranda more plausible.
It makes the valuation opinion, the fairness opinion, more plausible. That's correct.
And as well TD, as that's the Canadian bank?
TD is the Canadian investment bank.
Now, if there were no misrepresentations, but nevertheless this desire to make Noranda shares look more valuable in order to increase the likelihood of the tender offer succeeding, would that be a violation of the securities laws? Or is that just background to the alleged misrepresentations?
We allege it's a violation of the securities laws, both 10B.
Why? If it's all in the open, why would it violate anything?
Well, while the issuer bid is public, the intent of the issuer bid is not, nor are the mechanics of the when-issued market. In fact, here we allege that the defendants made a series of misrepresentations.
Well, I know that, but suppose they don't say anything. They just make the issuer bid, and then they make the tender offer, and that's it. They haven't said anything, and they haven't said anything to the bank. They haven't said anything to the shareholder. They haven't said anything. They just, you know, just.
Well, under the cases that we cite,
under
the cases that we cite, Alabama Farm Bureau, Crane, Philco, a couple of others, where you manipulate the price of the stock.
Understand what you mean by manipulation. They're making this. They do want to make their common stock more valuable by offering the preferred at a high price. But it's all obvious to everybody. So, who could be harmed?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's all that obvious. And in fact, we allege that it's not.
I don't understand you. If there's just a public offering, they say, look, we'll give you preferred stock worth, I don't know, $20 or something. You give us a common share, we'll give you this preferred share. And then now they've jacked up the price of their common, and that makes it more likely for their tender offer to succeed. Where's the fraud in that?
Well, I think if they state that the purpose of...
Well, they're stating nothing.
Then, under the cases that we cite, I believe that we've pled a claim under both Section 9 and under Section 10.
I don't understand. If no one is fooled, what possible harm is there?
Well, Your Honor, we were fooled. I mean,
I don't understand you. If there are no representations, where's the deception?
The deception is in the manipulation of the price of the stock.
Well, what if they said, look, we want to do this tender offer. We want as many Falcon Bridge shareholders as possible to tender. And so we're going to make our stock more valuable by offering this swap of preferred for common. Suppose they said all that. Then would there be any possibility of a fraud?
I'm sorry, they actually told us the intent of the issuer bid?
The intent of the issuer bid, yeah, suppose they said the intent of our issuer bid is to increase the number of Falcon Bridge shares that will be tendered to us. Is there any fraud in that?
Well, it's a violation of Reg M, and that, you know, under the cases that we cite, that clearly is, at least in the SEC's eyes, market manipulation and fraudulent.
Well, but how could anybody, who would be hurt? I don't understand.
I'm sorry.
Who would be hurt?
Who would be hurt? Okay. We would be hurt to the extent that people tendered, relying on the manipulated price of Noranda stock.
But they know it's being manipulated.
Well, we don't allege that, Judge. And in fact, we're supposedly, according to the defendants, the most sophisticated folks in the world. And if you look at our complaint letter, we say absolutely nothing about the manipulation of the price of the stock. And in fact, we allege we were unaware of it throughout the course of this transaction.
Okay. Well, I'll stop pestering you now. So, and we can give you some more time. So tell us what is the most serious misrepresentation that the defendants made.
Well, I think, Judge, there's a series of them.
I asked you for the most serious.
The failure to disclose the previous offer by Inco to buy Falcon Bridge minority shares.
And it was Inco that later paid more for Falcon Bridge?
40% more. 3 months later.
Okay. And all right, what's the second most serious?
I'm sorry, I just noticed my time. The second most serious is the cascade of errors in the valuation, oftentimes ranging between $500 million and $1 billion, errors with respect to earnings per share, EBITDA, net debt, consensus analyst estimates, $6 or $7 billion errors, all going in Naranda and Brascan's favor, and all to the detriment of the.
And are these errors communicated to TD and influencing its valuation? Is that the?
That's exactly right. Senior management of the firm, and this is set forth in the TD valuation. Senior management of the firm provided all of the underlying data that TD used. TD basically was a calculator here, using data provided by senior management.
Okay, fine. Well, we'll give you more time on rebuttal, so you don't have to worry.
Thank you, Judge.
So, Mr. Markle?
Yes, Your Honor. It's not important, but I pronounce it Markel, but in any case.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. Should I proceed?
Sure.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is a highly sophisticated hedge fund, and there is no fraud here. And I think that is the essence of our argument. And the fact that there is no fraud, that they were aware of all the things that they now claim they weren't aware of, is important for a number of reasons. First of all, of course, this is an individual action. It's not a class action. They're suing on their own behalf, and it's a litigious company. But the fact that they were not deceived by anything leads to several conclusions. One, for fraud, you have to have deception. You have to be deceived. Second, there's a necessity of proving reliance. That's in Your Honor's opinion in Isquith in the Seventh Circuit. It's also in Stone Ridge earlier this year in the Supreme Court. Reliance is an element of a fraud claim under the securities laws. Third, the fact that they were not deceived, I think indirectly, you know, it reads on the question of.
How do you know they weren't deceived?
All right, let me. If I may, Your Honor, I'd like to run through that, and I'll do it in detail. Okay,
So Mr. Barber said the most serious deception is this failure to disclose the INCO offer. So why wasn't that deceptive?
Well, Your Honor, if you go to SA 120 and 123, which is their letter to the it's to the special committee, but it was written on the same day that their counsel sent it to the Ontario Securities Commission.
Attachment to their complaint or something
it's
you
an atta-
introduced?
Your Honor, it is something that is.
You want us to take judicial notice of it?
I do, because it went to the Ontario Securities Commission, but I'm not offering it for the truth of the matter asserted, but simply for the fact that they knew about this. Because this went, their letter was attached to a letter by their counsel to the Ontario Securities Commission. Now, on page one, on the INCO bid, on 120, which is page two of their letter, item two, page two, number two. Item four. TD Securities has understated the value of Falcon Bridge because its comparable precedent transaction analysis omits any consideration of the ability to pay of competing strategic buyers such as INCO Limited, INCO. And then it goes on at great length. I won't quote the entire paragraph. But they clearly were focused on this plaintiff, not a class, this plaintiff was focused on the potential for INCO to bid. Okay? They were focused on it. Then if you go to page 123 and SA 123, this is in their appendix, they reiterate the INCO point. They say in the fourth paragraph, the one potential purchaser that may be able to achieve material operating cost synergies that TD Securities refers to is INCO. And indeed, there would be significant cost synergies if INCO and Falcon Bridge were to merge. And then it goes on at length about why INCO would have synergies. Moreover, there is disclosure in the documents that there was discussion by Naranda with other companies about potential acquisitions prior to the time of these bids.
Was there an offer made by INCO?
No, but that is not in the record. But there was no offer.
Well, Mr. Barber said there was an offer.
Yes, I know, Your Honor. He did say that. And he happens to be wrong, but it's outside the record. But what is relevant is that if that offer was not accepted, but they knew that Inco that was the most likely buyer, the most attractive buyer, had tremendous synergies, Your Honor, that one item is simply not material to because of the other disclosures. There is case law that
we have to accept, don't we, that there was an undisclosed offer?
I believe, Your Honor, I believe at this point you do.
Right. So you're saying, although we're assuming there was an undisclosed offer, its teeth were pulled, in effect, by disclosures that were made, that Inco was very interested and there would be synergies and so on. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm saying that, Your Honor. We also cited cases which said that there is no requirement to disclose offers that have been terminated and rejected. Okay? They're talking about something they claim happened 6 months before the March offers. So there is no duty to disclose prior negotiations that have been terminated. They don't allege that there is an ongoing negotiation or an open offer with Inco. That allegation is not in the complaint. Okay? So there's no. We also argue there's no duty to disclose.
But I guess, their basic argument is that this is a scheme to get Falconbridge cheap, concealing the fact that Inco had made an offer. Now, why isn't that at least a good allegation, whatever the truth is, why isn't that a good fraud allegation?
Your Honor, I can only reiterate the two things. One, there's no duty to disclose that because it's a past offer that was not accepted. It's not it's not open at the time of the offer that Naranda is making for the exchange, number one. And so it's not, there's no offer outstanding at that date, and that is not alleged. And number two, the substance, what's important here is the investment opportunity of an alternative buyer, right? There's an alternative buyer. They argue at length in their papers that...
Of course, what's critical is the price the alternative buyer would pay.
That's true, but their argument is the alternative buyer would pay more than the offer that was on the table, number one. Otherwise, why? That's the whole point of this letter to the OSC. And number two, they do not allege in the complaint what the offer was from Inco. There was no offer. There was no disclosure. So the comparison of the two would be relevant, but they don't allege it.
Okay. Go ahead.
You want me to? I can address, Your Honor. I can go on with my argument, or address.
No, go ahead, whatever you want.
Okay. Well, I would like to talk some more about another item because, Your Honor, it's really, I believe, the substance of the manipulation, the alleged manipulation.
What about the didn't Naranda claim that the purpose of the swap of the preferred for the common was to increase market capitalization and also increase Naranda's flexibility? Didn't it say that?
They may indeed have said that, Your Honor.
What sense does that make? How do you increase market capitalization by swapping one type of security for another?
Good question. I don't have an answer. I would have to think about that. Probably ask a financial expert to get the answer to why it increases.
Well, I don't think it can. Anyway, why isn't that fraudulent? That is, if they said, well, the reason we want to we want this swap is we want to make sure we get all these Falconbridge stockholders out of there because we want to sell Falconbridge for a lot of money.
Because, Your Honor, this plaintiff was not deceived. Even for the sake of argument, if you assume that statement was fraudulent, and I don't believe it is, let's assume it's fraudulent. I'll take your assumption. This plaintiff was not deceived. They've written at great length. But this document is extraordinarily important. Their letter to the OSC. That it is absolutely clear that they believed that this, that in fact these transactions were designed to get a good price for Noranda. That's what they said, right? So they were not deceived. And I, Your Honor, once again going back to your decision in Isquith, deception is necessary for the for there to be reliance here.
Because they're selling Noranda short, they must be pessimistic about it. Is that, that your argument?
Oh, Your Honor, I mean, if I may just take a moment.
I don't understand why you're not arguing that. That sounds like a powerful argument.
I think they were, Your Honor, but I thought Your Honor covered that quite well.
How big was their hedge with Falconbridge? I mean,
my understanding from the information we've been able to get is
could be the hedge on Falconbridge rather than vice versa. So what was their relative investment in these two?
I don't have the dollars, Your Honor. I know there was a hedge. I know that.
Which is hedging which, right? Because that would determine what they were more interested in, right?
I think that hedges by their nature go in both directions if they're offsetting positions.
Yes, but they're not equal, right? You don't have an equal. If you have equal hedges, you don't make any money. So one of them is small.
I will take Mr. Barber's at his word. I don't know that the investment in Noranda was less than the one in Falconbridge.
That's very important because if their major investment is in Falconbridge, then what is going long in Falconbridge? Then they think Falconbridge is undervalued.
But
they're not positive. They don't want to, make a big mistake. So they short Noranda, and that gives them some protection. But if Falconbridge is their major investment, then they're going to be hurt if you guys, your clients, try to get their Falconbridge stock cheap.
But Your Honor, if I may, and you can tell me to keep quiet if you've heard it too much already. That letter shows, and could I just run through the things they said in the letter in summary form?
Sure.
Okay. At page S119 to 120, they said TD Securities overvalued Noranda Securities and undervalued Falconbridge. This is all before they took the tender offer. Two. At page 120, SA 120, these are all SAs, they say TD miscalculated EBITDA. At the same page, they say TD used the wrong methodology. Page 120 and 123, they say that the Inco was an attractive purchaser who would likely pay more. At 4, they say TD was not independent, and they give details about why they were not.
Is this all before they tendered?
Yes, all before they tendered.
You're saying before they tendered, they knew that.
Absolutely. That's why this
Falconbridge was being undervalued.
It says it in over and over and over again in this document. This is a document that runs from page 119 through 130 of the SA of the record of supplemental appendix. But there's more. They talk about conflicts of interest of the special committee and the fact that Mr. Wallens wasn't independent at page 121. They question the diligence of the special committee at 121. They question whether there were prior undisclosed valuations at 121. On page 104, this is important, throughout the appendix to this letter, they say, they're calculating alternative values for Noranda, which are lower than what TD says, and they go time and time again say that TD overvalued Noranda. Before they tendered, they say estimated Noranda offer value per share equals 177 exchange ratio multiplied by Noranda's last unaffected price of 1860 on March 7, 2005. So they went back before the issuer bid,
about,
Your Honor.
What about this possibility? Suppose that They know that Falconbridge is undervalued, but the other shareholders of Falconbridge don't know. The other ones have been fooled, and so Stark tenders because it doesn't want to end up as a minority shareholder.
Well, two problems with that, Your Honor. First,
because Naranda just owned 49%, right, of Falconbridge.
No, I believe it was 41, Your Honor.
41%. Okay, so what's wrong with that theory?
A whole series of things are wrong with it, Your Honor. First of all, the only cases that adopt that are cases where the forced seller doctrine applies. In Your Honor's decision in Isquith, Your Honor said Your Honor's opinion for this court questioned whether there was any life left in the forced seller doctrine. Okay, this is an individual action, not a class action. We would be talking about very different things, right? But in this action, they need the forced seller doctrine to get there, and Your Honor has questioned that in Isquith, number one. Number two, they weren't forced because they tendered before the percentage that was necessary was achieved. Number three, there is no case post-Isquith in this circuit which it uses the forced seller doctrine. Number four, there is no case anywhere where the plaintiff knew of the fraud and was not literally forced to sell, but chose to sell, which is what they did. They may have been afraid they might get locked in, but they were not forced to sell. There's no case anywhere with those two facts. Nowhere. All their cases are not on point on what I'm about to say. No case anywhere where people are aware of the fraud and are not forced to sell, and they're permitted where it's found that they in fact relied on the fraud. This is a reliance claim, defense rather. We've got a no fraud defense, but we've got a reliance defense. They simply did not rely on what they now claim is the fraud. Right? And there were alternatives open to them. They could have chosen, as Your Honor says said in Isquith, this is really a corporate governance case. It is in the sense of if they were misused or mistreated by management, the remedy is not to bring a fraud claim. The remedy is to follow whatever the jurisdiction's remedies are for getting an unfair price. They did start the process, but they didn't finish it. And they made a choice. They tendered, and then they sued. And that's consistent with their history of being highly litigious. They have many suits in the United States. They've sued in Canada. This is part of their investment strategy. But I won't go there.
No, we're not interested in that.
Right.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Markell.
Can I make one other point, Your Honor, because I do think it's important, and I don't think it's been emphasized enough in our papers. Section 11, by its very terms, excludes claims where the person acquiring the securities knew of the untruth or omission. This is in the statute itself. It says if there's a misstatement in a registration statement, but in that first paragraph of Section 11 it says unless it is proved that at the time of such acquisition he knew of such untruth or omission, the fact that they knew the facts kills all their claims. It kills their fraud claims because there's no fraud, there's no deception. It kills their fraud claims because there's no reliance. It kills their Section 11 claim because the statute makes that clear in so many words.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Allerhan, are you arguing too?
May it please the Court, Joseph Allerhan on behalf of Appalee Braskin. Just a follow-up, Your Honors. The letter that you've heard so much about that was written to the Ontario Securities Commission and to the Special Committee of Falconbridge was referred to extensively at paragraph 205 of their complaint. And under the PSLRA, clearly, Your Honors, that's incorporated by reference, and there was every right of the magistrate judge to look at the letter as a whole as opposed to relying on the incomplete references to the letter in the complaint. Your Honor, I represent someone on this appeal who is not a speaker. Under the federal securities laws, there's no dispute that if you don't speak, you cannot be liable for material misstatement or omission. The plaintiffs are...
What if you're a ventriloquist?
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's exactly what they're trying to say, is that somehow under sections 15 and 20, my client is a control person, the ventriloquist, controlling the disclosures made by others. Your Honors, under the Harrison test, Judge Kane, you were on that panel more than 15 years ago in the Seventh Circuit, it's very clear you cannot have control liability absent a showing under the second prong, you need two prongs, that there was power or the ability to control the specific transaction that's at issue in the lawsuit. Your Honors, how did my client Brascan have any power or ability to control first the Falconbridge tender offer? That's what they're complaining about, that they tendered their shares for a price that was too low. That was an offer that was negotiated by an independent committee of Falconbridge directors. Their own complaint does not allege that anyone on that committee was affiliated with my client Brascan. My client Brascan doesn't own a single share of Falconbridge Securities and therefore could not have ensured the success of that tender offer. And with respect to the issuer bid, there was also a committee set up of Naranda which reviewed the terms of that bid. I would submit, Your Honors, you never have to reach this issue because we believe that the magistrate judge was absolutely correct. There is no underlying claim here that survives scrutiny, whether under the language of Section 11 or plain common sense. This plaintiff was aware of everything that occurred. And to pick up on what Judge Posner said coming out on the bench, I would reiterate, there is no market manipulation when there is disclosure.
Has Naranda ever been a defendant in this case?
I believe Naranda became New Falconbridge, so it doesn't exist, Your Honor, as a corporate entity. The case was brought after the merger.
After the tender offer, Naranda, in effect, merged into Falconbridge or changed its name or something.
Exactly, Your Honor.
So, okay.
And by the way, can anyone identify where the deception or the fraud is? The documents make it clear my client wanted to cash out of its position in Naranda. The last I looked, that's not against the law to say that we have a big position, we don't want to be in that investment.
What about the representation about market capitalization and flexibility?
Yeah, I saw that, Your Honor. It's one of seven purposes that are cited in the issuer bid.
Doesn't make any sense.
I'm going to give it a shot. I could be wrong. I think what they're saying is if you look at what the valuation they expect for the preferred shares in light of the redemption provisions, and you value the preferred shares at $25 or whatever the redemption is, that will increase the market capitalization because the common stock was valued at a lower level before. That's my lawyer's, at least, understanding of why it was number six on the items of what they think the issuer bid will do. And again, I don't understand the manipulation in that. I think that's what they meant, Your Honor. But again, I don't want to practice investment banking as a lawyer, but I've done it for 30 years, so I'll give it a shot, Your Honor. But basically, there's just no manipulation is one of the hardest claims to prove under the federal securities laws. Harvey Goldschmidt, my partner, always tells me it has to be a wash sale, a match sale. It's very specific types of activities. It is never engaging in an issuer bid where they say, we're doing this bid because Brascan would like, in part, to get out of this investment. But everyone else had the chance to subscribe to that bid. You know, this plaintiff, what's amazing about this case, they bought 5.5 million shares of Falconbridge stock after the issuer bid had been commenced and disclosure was made, after the tender offer was made to the Falconbridge shareholders. They knew all what was going on. They came in, they put a hedge on, they complained to the Ontario Commission, they wrote to the special committee. This is not what the federal securities laws are all about.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Allahan. So, Mr. Barber, we'll give you a couple of minutes.
Thank you, Judge. First, I'd like to point out that with respect to the INCO bid, not only was the bid not disclosed, but they affirmatively misrepresented that the most synergistic purchase...
What was the bid?
Excuse me?
What was the bid?
The bid, we allege that the bid was higher than the bid that they made for the shares.
Well, how much was it?
We don't allege the exact amount of the bid, Your Honor, because we don't know.
How do you know it's higher?
Based on the statements that were made, that we cite in the complaint, that were made by INCO after the fact. There were huge synergies for INCO. $300, $400 million of synergies that, quite frankly, resulted in the 40% premium that INCO paid 2 months down the road.
What about Mr. Allahan's last point? He says you bought this stock after the tender offer was announced, and you had written this letter to the Ontario Commission complaining about all sorts of shenanigans. So where was your reliance? Weren't you gambling?
Well, a couple points, Your Honor. First of all, we bought shares after the deal was announced, after we got the tender offer materials. There was an extensive investigation. It was only right before the tender offer was completed that we actually learned of the things that we disclosed in the letter. Bottom line is there's a series of investment decisions. It's only the investment decision to tender where
we did
not take reliance.
Well, this letter you wrote to the Ontario Commission, when was that in relation to when you actually tendered?
April 29th, and the tender date was May 6th. And at the end, bottom line, judges, is that we don't need to plead reliance in connection with the investment decision to tender.
You didn't have to tender, right? You could have held on to your stock.
Well, actually, Judge, we were in a very bad situation. If we failed the tender, we had no guarantee of dissenters' rights. We potentially gave up our federal securities law claims, and we had no claims on...
No guarantee of dissenters' rights.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
What do you mean you'd have no guarantee of dissenters' rights? If you end up as a minority shareholder, you do have rights.
No, actually, no, Judge. Their disclosure documents make it very clear that there is no guarantee of dissenters' rights. It's only if they get a certain number of shares and they structure the transaction as a merger versus some other form of combination that we would actually get dissenters' rights. That's in their disclosure documents. They say in big black letters, no guarantee of dissenters' rights.
Don't you have statutory dissenters' rights?
I'm sorry,
Judge. Don't you have statutory dissenters' rights?
Those are the dissenters' rights they're referring to. That under Canadian law, apparently, I'm just going by what they say in their disclosure documents, we had no guarantee of dissenters' rights. If we didn't tender, we could potentially lose our federal securities law claims. And in essence, we're left in a situation where we have a duty to the fund.
When you bought Falconbridge stock, right? You knew you didn't have the same. You knew you didn't have the same protection you'd have in the U.S., right? You took that risk.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily true, Judge. But at the end of the day,
you bought into a company that was 41% owned by Noranda.
Actually, Judge, I think counsel misspoke. It was 59% owned by Noranda. The publicly traded tail was 41%.
So when you bought this stock, you knew you were going to be a minority shareholder who could be squeezed out without the benefits of U.S. Protections for minority shareholders.
If we were squeezed out, if that was the sole transaction we were talking about, then I would agree with your statement that we might not have the benefit of federal securities laws. But we were talking about a tender offer that was being announced with a U.S.-listed stock, New York Stock Exchange stock, as the consideration, pursuant to a registration statement being filed with the SEC. So I don't think
you had suspicions about Noranda's valuation of Falconbridge.
We had suspicions by April 29th. That's absolutely correct.
So are you saying you bought this stock? You bought the stock before you had the suspicions?
Judge, we commenced buying stock on March 17th after the announcement in the analyst call and before they even filed the disclosure documents. We continued buying stock and then at some point discovered these issues and then immediately raised them with the appropriate authorities, the Special Committee and the Ontario Securities Commission.
Did you keep buying stock after that?
I don't believe we bought any stock after April 29th.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to say?
One quick point, Judge. Appellees cite a case for the notion that we had to plead reliance, which is not the case, but the case, which is the Eckstein case, as they cite the district court case from Wisconsin, that case was overturned on the very point they cited for by this court at 8 Fed 3rd 1121, and I would commend the court to read that case because it is basically very analogous to this case. And in that case, this court found that the plaintiffs did not need to plead reliance and that they could prove causation under circumstances that were identical to this case.
Okay, well, thank you very much.